You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, for this week's episode, I'm doing something a little different. I generally don't talk to artists about their own work, but in this case, the opportunity was just too good to pass up. The photographer Steven Seidenberg makes beautiful photographs that are both visually and conceptually striking. But what really hooked me in was that his recently published collection documents a story that I was unfamiliar with. Longtime listeners probably already know, I'm largely a modernist at heart. I've read so many accounts of the early to mid 20th century and artistic development and history, but I was not familiar with this little incident funded by the Marshall Plan that seemed like it was set up to fail. I don't want to give too much away, but Seidenberg's books, Architecture of Silence, Abandoned Lives of the Italian South, is filled with haunting and yet beautiful images documenting the ruins. And the companion book, Distant Voices, on Steven Seidenberg's Architecture of Silence, is a collection of essays from historians, critics, philosophers, and others giving us the context to make sense of the photographs. In this episode, I spoke with Steven Seidenberg and Carolyn White, who edited Distant Voices, so they could explain the history behind the ruins and share some insights into the photographic process. If you want to see more of Steven's work, go to stevenseidenberg.com, or of course, check the show notes where I'll link to his site and provide links where you can purchase both books.
I feel like who Art Ed.
I'm trying to spice it.
Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, weekly art history for all ages. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and today I'm excited. I actually have two guests. We're breaking format just a little bit. I have the photographer, Steven Seidenberg, and Carolyn White, who have worked collaboratively on two books, correct? One is a photography book, and one is a collection of essays about sort of the ruins of what was left after something didn't go so well on the Marshall Plan. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, Marshall Plan funded a program that was implemented by the newly formed Italian Republic after the war, post-war.
So. Yeah. And I was excited about this because longtime listeners know I am like a World War II nerd. I am just such the modernist at heart. I've done episodes, made reference to the Ghost Army and all sorts of stuff that happened around that era, the post-war era. I feel like that middle of the 20th century was such a critical time in at least Western art history, and so much happened shifting our perspectives. And when I saw that you had a book that was documenting some of that stuff, I was absolutely fascinated. So I guess to get into this, normally I would be doing all the heavy lifting on the background part, but it seems kind of ridiculous when you quite literally wrote the book on the topic. So if I can just get started, your book is about the ruins of the, and you're going to have to help me out, Riforma Fondiaria. And that was the post-war land reform policy in, and I can't get this, Basilicata and Puglia.
And Puglia.
Like I suddenly changed to a different imitation of an accent. I don't know where that second one came from. Can you give us the right pronunciation for that?
Yes, it's Basilicata and Puglia. It was also implemented in Calabria and in parts of Tuscany as well. So
it was
so through poor what were then quite poor agricultural regions historically dominated by large estate level culture, agriculture rather. Carolyn, you can come in. Essentially, these big estates that before the war had been the centerpiece of traditional agriculture in Italy, with large land holdings controlled by essentially a kind of aristocracy, and peasants, so to speak, village level peasants who would come and work in the harvests and the plantings and things like that. After the war, there was a movement to redistribute land generally throughout Italy from these big estates, many of which had been fascist aligned. There was a large communist movement in particular, a left-wing movement, and the very active and important Communist Party in post-war Italy was arguing for this kind of land reform. And the Allies and the Americans in particular took this and other parts of that left agenda and appropriated them to policies of the newly formed republic, in part to prevent the communists from taking power or from being elected, I should say. And they did so in a way, though, that was fairly destructive, as it turns out. So the money came from the Marshall Plan, or much of it did. And then the Italian government started implementing the policies.
Okay, so and that's where I want to jump in and ask a little question, because as I'm understanding it, it sounds to me like in the post-war era, it's almost like the shift away from feudalism. The peasants are no longer just working the land. They wanted the ordinary people to have an ownership stake in that land, right? And that's so they're dividing it up. And, you know, maybe it's just the lefty in me. I'm sitting here thinking, well, how could this go wrong? So how did it go wrong? You've alluded to, we've already said there are ruins there that you were documenting, and you've said it all fell apart. So where did this go off the rails?
Well, it went off the rails in many directions. There were a lot of things that kind of came together to make things go wrong. It was underfunded. It was overly ambitious in terms of the building that people did. They spent all the money on land improvement and building these thousands and thousands of houses. And of course, they also saw a long-term benefit in having this go wrong. So once the land was distributed to these people, they had 2 free years to live there and work the land. And then that third year, they had to start paying rent. And there was never irrigation. There was never electricity, despite the promises that were made. And so it was impossible for people to survive on the basically 7 acres of land that they were given by the Italian government. Yeah. They couldn't make it work. And so the Italian government benefited ultimately because people abandoned the farms, moved north, and the land reverted back to the state.
And subsequently, the state then sold the land to these large corporate agricultural interests. So there was essentially Italy managed in a 20-year period to move in these regions from feudal agriculture to modern corporate agro-business, with the casualties of the cultures of all of these places being lost, all of these village level cultures lost, all of these families scattered, and all of those laborers, those people, those potential landowners, often moving north to man the factories for the new industrialization of the north, for car making and other kinds of industrial enterprise.
So it's feudalism by another name, essentially. I'm just curious, what is it about this story that drew your attention? You know, why did this one jump out at you? Because I'm gonna be honest, I like happy stuff, and I'm thinking about like ruins and stuff. I mean, it's a story to be told, but why did this appeal to you?
Well, I'll tell you, in some ways, I think that at least for me and my art practice, and in the way I understand art practice in general, and in particular photography, it's a politically activated genre automatically by virtue of its relationship, at least lens-based photography. There are obviously kinds of photography that aren't lens-based, alternative process, mm-hmm. and things like that. And I'm interested in the aesthetically moving, but I'm also interested in understanding art practice as consequential, semantically consequential, in the case of photography in particular, and politically consequential. And so, in fact, happy stuff is not motivating in particular. It's not demotivating necessarily, but it's not an intrinsic motivation by any means. I hope that there's a kind of pathos, but also a sense of sublimity that comes, which is a happy sense, I think, in that mm-hmm. it's a kind of pleasure, but it's not a simple pleasure. It's a complex pleasure, let's say.
Yeah. I mean, I get that statement that, you know, sort of everything is inherently on some level a political statement. Even my choice to, you know, paint a seagull playing a guitar is on some level, you know, a statement about my priorities. But I think you're right. There is a simple, like looking through the book and the way that you frame the shots, there is something that I was really surprised at how visually, just like aesthetically pleasing the photographs were. Like I'm looking at, you know, the way that you framed things, your use of door frames and window frames to create that juxtaposition of the vivid, bright, bold countryside, you know, framed by these ruins and other stuff like that. I mean, we can get into the weeds a little bit later, but I think you're right. There is something that is pleasing in some way about yes. these dilapidated structures that surprised me because yeah. it's not the kind of thing that immediately draws my attention.
Well, I'll put a finer point on it in the sense that, you know, the structures themselves are not so pleasing. There's something pleasing about the images of the structures, which I take as pleases me that you feel that way and that people feel that way in seeing the images. And there is something for me when I choose subjects for my work in finding the unseen, the unspoken, in other projects of mine, things that are structures that are liminal in the urban landscape or in the rural landscape, or things that are seen as blighted and that people you're also right in your suggestion that or your allusion to the limited amount of time people want to spend thinking about and talking about painful subjects. And so this is something that part of what was ultimately so intriguing about these structures was how difficult it was for people to talk about them in the regions and how shameful it was for them, even though to a large extent this is true in many places. They were the victims of this policy and the victims of these of this movement, the way in which this movement was structured to disenfranchise them, but people respond to being victimized with shame often, and that's what we see still. But younger generations, of course, can be a little bit more distance and can try to talk about what their grandparents and parents went through in these moments.
I'm sorry. I want to unpack that a little bit, because the teacher in me, as I think about like my art curriculum, I'm always talking about cultural context in which things were created and what art reveals about the day-to-day lives and the experiences of people. And as I'm understanding what you're talking about, the way that people see a shame in this, the way I perceive this as an outsider, I was thinking this is an example of how, you know, if you don't build the infrastructure that people need to live and to sustain life, you know, giving them one resource but not adequate resource, like the resource of the land, but not the resources of the infrastructure and everything to build a full, complete life around it, nobody can succeed under those circumstances. And to me, it reads as a government failing. But you are saying that the people on the ground felt it almost as a personal failing and point of shame, like they were given an opportunity but couldn't make it work. Am I understanding that correctly?
I think that it goes back and forth between thinking about it as an opportunity they were given that they couldn't capitalize on, and being duped into thinking it was an opportunity when in fact they should have known better. And because in particular in the Italian, say in Basilicata and Puglia and Calabria, the Italian South, it has been largely discriminated against and broadly discriminated against by the cultural areas north of Rome, let's say, south of Rome and north of Rome, remain really distinct in that respect. And often the racism that you see in Italy around north-south distinctions is now much more broadly the racism that you see around new migrants and other people coming through who are not, who don't meet the particular version of Northern European whiteness. And so there is a sense in the South of like, I can't believe they took advantage of us again. They told us they were going to do something they didn't. What a surprise, you know. But at the same time, of course, what we know to be the case is that that they were living in such extraordinary poverty already, that for many of them, they did think, well, this probably won't work, because this is probably them taking advantage of us again. But we have nothing to lose, essentially, or we have so little to lose.
Yeah, I mean, when you're drowning, you don't wait around for the right color of life jacket.
Exactly. And yeah,
there's a documentary in Italian from the period that shows government officials bestowing these spaces onto the population, and they interview them, you know, are you going to go? Are you excited? And one of the women responds in Italian, you know, of course I'm going to go. I live in a cave.
Oh, I feel bad laughing at that.
Yeah. You know, but they say we'll have gas, we'll have water, you know, it'll be better, right?
Yeah.
One thing I think that is, just to stay on this for a moment, that is interesting that Steve alluded to, is now that there are multiple generations separating the inhabitants of those spaces, well, number one, people seem to think that people really didn't live there at all. And that's one thing that I think that the photographs truly reveal, is that people did make those spaces into their homes, however temporarily they were. So you have furniture and other kinds of decor, and the paint, the other ways that they made them into domestic spaces. So that's one thing that's quite interesting. And then you also have people who have heard about the time that their families may have spent in those houses now. So whereas this idea that it was just this huge failure, no one lived there, now you can start to see, in conjunction with this work, more stories about why it's interesting to people, why it is part of the the oral heritage of a family about this, their stint in those fields before they abandon it to move north or move back into their village. So I think, again, with the passage of time and with this kind of photography, it helps to see the time as it was, not just as this failure, even though at the same time, it really underscores how many people were put in really difficult situations and had to make the difficult choice to leave.
Yeah. And I think one of the things I really appreciate about your book, or I should say books, because it's essentially two companion pieces. And for listeners, I'm going to have links in the show notes if you want to buy a copy. But we've got the one book of The Architecture of Silence, which is the photography book where we can see it all laid out. And then you also have the Distant Voices book, which is the collection of essays. And I love that you sought out diverse perspectives on that. Like you had interviews from like architects and critics, and as you've already said, you've talked to people living there for generations. I'm curious, you know, we've talked about the one lens of like you know, the people who lived there and their families, and I can't believe we got fooled again kind of perspective. Did other people with different lenses talking about it, maybe a little bit removed from history, did they see something different? Are there commonalities, common threads you saw through the descriptions of it, or any different insights you noticed there?
Well, I think one thing that we were fortunate to be able to do was to bring perspectives from not just different kinds of occupations and positions in terms of how people might interact with photographs, but also the contributors come from many different places. So we have many Italians, some from the South, some from the North, some from Rome, some living abroad. And we have other people from Canada, from the US. One of the things that I think is quite interesting is how often the Italians say, both in this print, in print and in person, is that sometimes it takes someone from somewhere else to show us our history. Not to you know, pat ourselves on the back per se, but there is an advantage of being from the outside coming in, where you're able to see something valuable to explore. And I think that this, even the selection of these sites that you were talking about before, they didn't seem interesting to many people in Italy because they were so familiar. But to Steve and to me, driving past them when we first encountered them, they were something that to us demanded further investigation. Whereas people who have lived, you know, just a couple miles from these fields with so many houses just don't think of them as anything but, you know, little blips from the past.
And that's interesting.
I was just going to add, because I know it's something that a part of the way the questions that you have about the project, just the in terms of the composition of the pieces of the photographs, that part of the way in which I choose a photographic project is with the notion that the way I see through the camera will reveal the world anew, and will transform the world in a certain way, whether that's has a historical consequence or an aesthetic consequence or a material consequence in any particular way, in terms of how people walk through their everyday lives. It's the photograph is about seeing and understanding how to translate one's ability to see the world in a particular way through the camera.
That is so interesting to me, just because like I'm building off like the connection there to, you know, just the way that I approach photography with my students. As we talked about earlier, before I started recording, I alluded to the fact that photography is a medium that I struggled with, because I feel like photography is a medium that is relatively easy to start at and to get to a very basic level of competence. And then you have to study and work so much to notice any improvement from that base level at all. You know, it's really frustrating, but I love that idea that someone who actually knows photography talks about seeing the world through that photographic lens and transforming our view on it, because that's one of the few bits of advice that I give to my students. And it's really validating for me personally. This, I know you think this podcast is about you, but it's really about stroking my ego. but like my very first photo lesson with students, and I teach elementary, so I'm talking to, you know, 8-year-olds. I'll say, I want you to look through this camera's lens, and without any outside manipulations, I want you to look at something from such an extreme angle that it looks abstract, that I can't recognize it. It takes me a moment to figure out what it is, and also make it look good. Because, you know, I can hold it up against the wall and it's all black and it looks abstract and I have no idea what it is. But to make it look good, too, is the challenge. But I love that idea of your photographs and that fresh perspective. I mean, like you said, people in Canada and other parts of the world are seeing what is really fascinating about this. And I think that's a good reminder for all of us. Sometimes you need a little bit of distance to get that objectivity to really process and understand and get that outside perspective.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Now, if I can shift a little bit, we've already started to naturally segue there, because this is a space where I like to use an audio medium to get into the visual arts. Your photos are absolutely beautiful. Loved looking through the book. But I do want to know, how do you go about composing your shots? You've already alluded to, you know, you want something that you can see from a new angle or reveal something about the world. But how do you, when you're looking just like through the viewfinder, how are you deciding what's the right angle for this? You get what I'm saying. Like, how do you compose your shots? How do you, what's the steps you're going through there?
I mean, I'm thinking about it within, firstly, of course, in terms of the parameters of the camera that I'm using, what I think I can do with it, what I think this capture can result in. That is to say, for me, and I would say this to aspiring photographers, you need to print. You need to print your photos. If you don't print your photos, there's a point you can't progress past in the way that you understand what you're doing as a photographer, even if your ultimate goal is to only work with images online. Printing them changes your relationship to the understanding how the photograph, the moment of instant of capture, objectifies the world and what it means to translate the world from a three-dimensional space to a flat space, what it means compositionally, and what it means when one has the object of the photo in hand. So I'm always shooting, thinking about how I'm going to print what I'm shooting, which depends, and, you know, shooting towards a particular way of printing.
So you're looking at it from a materials perspective. You're thinking like, my aperture is rated at this and I've got this speed of film or whatever, or the sensitivity. And, you know, you're thinking about like how the silver halides will react and the grain size and all of that stuff in the photo. Or are you thinking of it more in terms of like, well, I want it to have this emotional resonance, and so I'm going to get it darker, lower the exposure time? Or is it about just like what physically can happen because of the depth of field and because of all of those material consequences? Or is it more that sort of, is it a gut level? Like, I'm inspired. I see this and I've got to capture it. And it just hits me on that emotional resonance, or is it a combination?
Well, it is, I think, primarily about emotional resonance, but emotional resonance happens within the context of them, mm-hmm. as it does in painting and other forms of composition, in the context and through the parameters of the medium you're using. And those parameters are all the things you're talking about, whether it's film or digital capture, mm-hmm. or what have you, and thinking about the ways in which the photograph can and the parameters of making a photograph can affect the emotional content of the photo and the impact of the photo, and also the relationship of one photo to another. So I often shoot in series and sort of with the notion that having this conceptual framework in which a series of photos is placed can heighten or amplify the emotional content, the emotional resonance of each individual photo. Even when they're taken out of that context, it can remain with you. This sense of having achieved the project, completed the project in relationship to this conceptual framework, whatever it may be.
So now, as I looked through the book, like I said, there were a number of photos that were very striking to me that I'm looking through, and I had to pause and take a moment and look more carefully at. I'm curious, is there a favorite of yours? I mean, I imagine you take so many. It's got to be hard to choose a baby, but like, is there anything that just like really you felt like, yes, this is the one that represents what I was trying to do here?
Well, you know, I mean, there are too many for me. It's in that way. I think that in many respects, it's such a difficult project to photograph interiors with bright exteriors, mm-hmm. Without a source of artificial light. And so some of those, I think, can have a really uncanny character, so that the scenes through the windows, for instance, to which you alluded earlier, the scenes of the outside almost have, because of the intrinsic shift in resolution that happens with brightness and having to bring down highlights that have problems with being overexposed. So I'm aware that that can reduce resolution in a way that gives those parts of the photograph a dreamy or painterly character, as though they're paintings. So that's one of the things that I would be shooting towards in this project, recognizing that I can make the scene outside and the scene inside, I can give them a relative poignancy through various techniques that will that I think is emotionally resonant for people when they see the photographs.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm listening to that. The thing that really perked my ear that surprised me was you said that you don't have an artificial light as you're shooting through the window. I'm looking at the book right now, page 26, 27, where you've got it's like a purplish wall with like I can see like mold and plaster and stuff, and it's got like the shutters framing that window, and the brightness of the landscape through that window. I admit I'm not good at photography. I'm not an expert, but I've dabbled enough to know that if I tried to take that shot, you know, we're talking it the walls are going to be almost black. You know what I mean? Like it's just to get the lighting and contrast right. I was blown away to hear that you did that without a secondary light source.
Because
my first thought was you must have had something so that it's not excessively like backlit or whatever you might want to, however you might want to describe it. But you're right. There is a painterly quality to it. There's something about it that I was really drawn to because I'm always trying to be the little bit of the optimist. And I think there's something so nice about the focal point that grabs my attention is this beautiful landscape. And there's something visually satisfying about symmetrical balance. You know, I absolutely love that in the framing of the shot. And it feels to me like a Magritte painting, which I've got a little bit of a soft spot for. Like my the cover art for my podcast is shamelessly ripped off a Magritte composition, but that photograph that you captured, I think it's all the more stunning to realize that was done without the tricks that I would have immediately gone to. I think of Chuck Close, who said, like, the magic is more impressive when you understand the work that went into it.
Yeah, it's difficult to do. It takes many, and it's also a single shot. It's not a composite shot, which people often think. It's sort of under, again, the having a clear idea of the limitations of your medium allows you, and your tools allows you to do extraordinary things with them, things that people haven't done before.
Well, hat is off to you on that, because I wouldn't have known the exposure time, the film speed, whatever variables you're working with. I don't know if there's a filter on the lens or what, but
it's
a beautiful image.
Thank you. And there are the all and the cover images, of course, another similar image of an interior, exterior. There are a few others. But as you say, you know, in a way, this is a book about frames within frames, the compositional frame of the photograph itself, but then the frames within the doorways, the windows, the pathways in and out that recapitulate the sense of pathos, I think, of entering a house that was never quite able to fully realize its potential to let people live in it, to have people thrive within it. It's one of the contributors, cultural critic and journalist and poet in Italy named Maria Teresa Carbone, says in the essay book, it's an abandoned, each house is an abandoned dream. And that's part of what the nature of the project for me is to recognize that and recognize that sacrifice and also the dreamlike character of it, of these spaces.
Yeah, that is a beautiful and slightly haunting way of describing it, but I think an apt description. And I think just to wrap up, the one thing I always like to do, you know, first season I would wrap up with just the takeaways from everything, and to summarize with all of this, I like to end on a positive. So since I've got a photographer who is, you know, in my estimation, absolutely brilliant at what he's doing, I would ask, what advice would you give aspiring photographers? If someone's looking to up their photo game, whether it's to get better Instagram pictures or they want to become a professional photography documenting the world, what tips would you give as a starting point?
First let me qualify that I happen to not use social media at all. So I don't know what it would be to what makes someone a better Instagram photographer, but I suppose they're just posting photographs on Instagram as opposed to some other place. Within that, if they have the wherewithal to make prints, I think that's a useful thing to do. But if not, to understand the photograph compositionally, maybe firstly, even in relationship to painting, to see that the same techniques that happen in the same modes of manipulation and modes of emotional resonance a painter can make happen in on a flat plane are similar to what happens for a photographer. And then photography also shares something, though, with what a sculptor is working with. That is, you have this, you have to deal with the way in which a three-dimensional world functions, the way in which exposure functions happens in three dimensions, not on a flat surface, even though you're transposing it onto a flat surface. So in some way, I think the best is to look at as much art as you can, identify the things in art practice, and of course, in the practices of other photographers whose work you admire, identify aspects that of that work, maybe not, if you, maybe you can't identify the compositional particulars, but you can identify the emotional particulars that draw you to that work and start to think about how you can find that in your own practice and your own way of seeing, even before you move to the camera and to making others see what you see.
I cannot second that more heartily. I think that is a really beautiful way of describing it. And once again, just to bring things full circle, perfectly suited for my personal needs and what I needed to hear as a not particularly talented artist, to know to intellectualize things, which is the only way that I have acquired any skill. Understanding the material science of the process and what is happening and how that can be manipulated, as well as the structure and of how a composition is arranged, those principles of design, of balance and contrast and emphasis and, you know, the rhythm and movement and how those things are structured. Just understanding the underlying structure of the arts, I think, is beautiful. And that's the goal that I have for this show. So everybody should be listening to my entire back catalog. In all seriousness, though, I cannot thank you enough. The books are absolutely gorgeous. Like I said, I'm going to link it in the show notes for anybody who wants to buy a copy. But once again, thank you for giving me your time and your expertise, Stephen Seidenberg and Carolyn White.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.